Final case on the court's calendar this morning is Nevada Power versus Ernest A. Becker and Kathleen C. Becker. This is case number 55180. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Please.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, Associate Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Mike Chapman. My co-counsel is Eric Storm. We're representing the Nevada Power Company. With permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. To begin, I put up a board, which we used to try just to orient the court to where the property is and what we're doing. We have a before condition and an after condition because it was a temporary acquisition. North is to the top. This is Rainbow here, and Blue Diamond is here. The property is a mini market and a gas station. You can see the mini market building and then the canopy over the gas pumps. The acquisition is an easement which runs right along the edge here of the property. It's a little bit back from the street because NDOT eventually widened Blue Diamond in that location. But anyway, the Riley transmission lines run down farther to the west and eventually come to the Riley substation. The acquisition was for the purpose of getting an easement here and installing right about this location right here a transmission tower. And so the issue was the value of the land taken at the time of trial plus severance damages, if any.
Mr. Chapman, with respect to your map and the before condition, how far south from the red line, which is the easement, did the Becker's property line exist?
It's basically right on that line, Your Honor. This kind of a no man's land portion between the paved road and the line is NDOT property.
Okay.
Which they expanded
so
into.
So the landowner's property line extends just adjacent to or just below the easement line.
True.
Okay.
And on the line, you can see from your vantage point, you're a little far away, Your Honor, but you can see where the pole went. Right in that spot also was a Shell sign with the gas prices on it. There were some pre-existing utility poles and lines also along in this area, including the name of the business.
Okay.
So at trial, the landowners sought in excess of $900,000 in compensation. The power company made an offer of judgment for $345,000, and the jury returned a verdict exactly on the amount of the power company's appraiser, which was $239,000.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the offer of judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not sure that the statement you just made are comparative. The offer of judgment recites that the sum that you offered of $345,000 would have been inclusive of recoverable attorney's fees, costs, and interest. The amount awarded by the jury didn't include costs or interest yet. So when the district court judge made its comparative analysis, shouldn't it have made the comparative analysis based on the offer of judgment as you presented it?
Either way, we would have exceeded the offer of judgment.
Well, maybe. There's an interesting question. You offered fees in the offer, and the district court, of course, under the statute, didn't award fees. Should the district court have considered whether fees were appropriate in this case because of your offer of judgment?
Well, our goal on the offer of judgment was to make the landowner whole at that point in time.
Well, I understand that, but your offer of judgment of $345,000 included costs, interest, and fees, right?
That was a total amount, yes.
The analysis by the district court compared the jury award, which didn't include costs or interest or fees, with your offer of judgment of $345,000. Was the comparison an accurate comparison?
Well, we don't believe that the district court actually looked at our offer of judgment. She simply, I mean, it was presented, but what Judge Vega did was, in actuality, come to the conclusion that the offer of judgment statutes didn't apply in eminent domain, So she just moved on by awarding to award the landowners their costs and interest. No one sought attorney's fees in the case, so that was not an issue in the court below.
Yeah, Mr. Chapman, let me go on to that point. Is why should the offer of judgment statutes apply in eminent domain cases? I mean, these are constitutional proceedings. You're taking their property for the easement, and if they're if like divorce cases are exempt from offers of judgment, why shouldn't a constitutional proceeding, as authorized by Chapter 37, be exempt as well?
Because the general law, and there are cases in other states which stand for this, is that fee statutes, cost statutes, and this kind of thing can apply in eminent domain cases unless there's a statute. The Nevada legislature has not enacted a statute which takes away the applicability of NRS 17115 or NRCP 68 in eminent domain cases. The legislature did consider that issue in 2003 when they had a bill called AB 397, and they considered this language that notwithstanding any other provision of law, no penalty may be imposed upon a person for rejecting an offer of judgment and proceeding to trial regardless of the outcome of the trial. The legislature rejected that. They defeated that law in 2003. And if we look at the statutes which are applicable in this case, NRS 37120 and the others, they do not contain language like this, which takes away the applicability of those two offer of judgment rules in eminent domain cases. So our position is that since the legislature could have easily provided, it's only one sentence long, which they have looked at before and rejected, and since they remain silent on that point, that under principles of statutory construction, where you need to look at the entire statutory scheme, all of the statutes that the legislature has enacted, including NRS 37200, which incorporates by reference into Chapter 37 all of the rules of the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, including the offer of judgment, NRCP 68, you cannot read the statutes to make a nullity of those automatically just because this is an eminent domain case.
Well, if the no penalty provision had passed the legislature, would that mean also you to attorney's fees?
Well, the no penalty provision did not pass the legislature.
That I know, but if it had, would you then be able to have attorney's fees in condemnation cases?
If the legislature enacted a statute that said the landowner or the government gets attorney's fees, then sure.
Well, right now the statute says no attorney's fees.
Correct.
37185. But if you pass another statute that says no penalty, if you were certainly in any type of litigation, you have to pay attorney's fees and costs. And should you get them back? In other words, what we're asking you is, does the condemnation statute trump the offer of judgment rules?
No.
Statute?
No, Your Honor. And the reason is that they are statutes. They need to be read in harmony. And the rules of construction, which this court has laid down over many, many years, is that you don't make a nullity out of one statute, and you don't create an absurd result, where a case like this, the taxpayers, or in our case, because it's the power company, the ratepayers, end up financing a frivolous litigation so that the landowner can take a free shot at $900,000 or plus dollars when they know and the jury concluded that the value of their case is much, much less and that the offer of judgment was extremely fair. The public policy principles still pertain to the offer of judgment rules.
Mr. Chapman, if we accept your argument, though, don't we then come back to to what Justice Hardesty originally raised, and that is the offer of judgment as stated, and how do we then deal with it in terms of it was broader than it seems to have been interpreted in terms of the offer of judgment and what the jury awarded?
The offer of judgment was simply to be inclusive of all of those matters, so that when the landowner accepted it, if they did, they would get $345,000 minus the amounts deposited already by the power company in the court.
But in determining the threshold question here is whether the offer of judgment statute somehow does not apply to a condemnation statute. And the only explanation I can see offered by the district court is on page 2 of the order, lines 23 through 25, in which the judge says, The court further finds that the statutory purposes of achieving just compensation for the landowner's loss would be circumvented by an award of cost to the plaintiff. But there's no constitutional analysis. There's not even any statutory analysis. Is there any other reason or justification or legal point that the judge relied upon in making this determination?
No, not that she cited in her order. That's why I mentioned earlier that she didn't really address the offer of judgment specifically in her order and explain her reasoning for that. We made an offer or a motion for cost based upon our offer. The landowners made an offer or a motion, rather, based upon their position, and that was the order that we got back. So,
Mr. Chapman, could I ask, in the interest of time, could I ask you about the interest issue? Is it your position the party stipulated to a certain date of the taking and that date should apply for the accrual of interest, or explain your thoughts on that?
There was no stipulation as to the date of the taking. What we have here are two separate lawsuits, which may be part of the confusion. In September of 07, the power company made an application to the court under NRS 37.055, which was heard by Judge Bixler, to be able to go onto the property for a very short time, temporarily, to survey the property, find the location of the Shell oil sign, the foundation of the where that was, make sure there were no underground utilities in the way. Then we got out. Then, in November of 2007, we filed the actual condemnation case after we were sure that what we were doing and had located the property and so on in Judge Vega's court. Then there was a full occupancy hearing held there for the purposes of the construction of the eminent domain or for the facilities. I believe that the landowners in their brief say that, well, we occupied the property in September for construction. That is not accurate. This construction on this property did not occur until after the first of the year.
Well, you were allowed essentially a physical invasion on that property, and didn't the order also allow you to drill test holes if you chose to?
It did, potholes. Right. But these are regarded as temporary inconveniences. The holes have to be filled back in. Per the statute, it does not give rise to a cause of action except for actual physical damage to the land, simply because it is not a permanent physical invasion of the property, which would constitute a taking.
Well, Mr. Chapman, case. There may not have been a stipulation with respect to occupants. It was a stipulation as to the valuation date. Why, of October 22nd, as I understand it, why is the district court judge's discretion abused in selecting that date as the interest date?
Well, because she is choosing September 14th, 2007 as the interest date, which is based upon a notice of entry of order in the Judge Bixler case, which is not of record in the Judge Vega case. It was never filed there. There's basically no support for that date. That is simply the calculation that the landowners use. We know where it came from because we were there, but it's not really of record in the case.
Did you record a list pendens on this property?
After November 20th of 2007. Not in the original case. And this goes on a lot, by the way. There are many, many times when the power company or other government agencies need to access property. Under the National Environmental Policy Act, for example, which governs in all cases of federal funding, you have to consider alternative routes. You just can't pick the one you think is the best. So you have to go on to different people's property, survey this and that before you can rule anything out. Those are not takings under the law.
And I presume you'll reserve the remainder of your time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Thanks very much.
Very well.
Good morning, Justices. John Netzorg on behalf of the Beckers. Your Honor, on October 17, 2007, a Nevada Power Company filed its action for eminent domain and recorded a notice of lis pendens. It also contemporaneously received an order shortening time.
What date was that, Mr. Smith? October 7th.
October 17th, 2007. It received an order shortening time for the landowners to appear at a hearing for an order for immediate occupancy. The Beckers were served on October 22nd, which is the stipulated valuation date pursuant to the statute. They were given less than 48 hours to prepare for the order of immediate occupancy hearing, to have an appraisal under the Pappas decisions, to present any defenses they might have on necessity or public purpose in threat of waiving those. 48 hours. I would suggest to the court that an order shortening time, considering the magnitude and the importance of a 37-100 hearing, per se, on its own, would suggest that the timing was unreasonable and that the condemnor had delayed the proceedings. After the verdict was entered, pursuant to the new statutes, and we have a lot of new things happening here. We have pistol, we have the 37-120. The Beckers made a request to have a 37-124 hearing on interest. And in those pleadings, we attached the earlier proceedings in front of Judge Bixler that you've heard about, the September 17th hearings. We attached the applications to Clark County for zoning from a year earlier, 2006. We attached the notices to these landowners. Attached to the complaint and the 48-hour occupancy notice for the landowners to come forward was a six-month-old appraisal that this condemnor had already obtained. What we're talking about here isn't a legitimate use of 37050 in September of 2007. It was a thinly disguised motion for immediate occupancy. And these are the concerns that this court has consistently repeated time and time again, whether it's in the Sisolak context of Buzz Stuck context of an independent claim for pre-condemnation conduct, or even Argier v. Nevada Power Company, where the court started articulating what the requirements were in the special requirements for NRS 37-100, which is, are we going to have a hearing on these issues? Argier, when did the taking take place? It was in the Argier case, Nevada Power Company conveniently effected a taking once it entered upon the property. And this is citing the Nolan versus California Coastal Commission case from the United States Supreme Court. Isn't that, in fact, what happened here? Are we kidding ourselves? Nevada Power was all loaded up for this condemnation action. They went into possession under the guise of 37.050, not to consider different locations. They had one-year-old plans showing that the transmission lines were going exactly wrong. On top of that, if you review the application that was made to Judge Bixler, there is an affidavit from James Sebevgra, who's the land agent for Nevada Power Company. And this is found at Volume 9, Tab 6, pages 1807 through 1867. Mr. Sebevgra, and this is what the trial judge had in front of her. She had the only testimony was an affidavit from Nevada Power stating, Nevada Power Company is proceeding to construct, operate, and maintain the Riley transmission line. This is paragraph two, but public need and necessity exists. And then they talk about the fast-growing need for this property and their need to get onto the location. And then this condemnor withholds its complaint for condemnation and then files it 1 month later with an order shortening time, giving the landowners and all of the landowners up and down Rainbow, no time.
What was the basis for the order shortening time?
I cannot imagine. I mean, what was the basis for it? They're in a big hurry and need to get this thing constructed by November 1st. The same basis as they articulate 1 month earlier in their supposed 37050. Because their 37050 affidavit is strikingly similar to the one for their order of immediate occupancy. It says here that it is critically important that this power line construction commence before November 1, 2007. So this is a situation where the condemnor has apparently or conceivably or factually may have withheld the filing of its complaint with no good reason. And the bottom result was that the property owners were given 48 hours to come in and defend themselves. As we've included in our briefs, some of the property owners were able to show up. Some of them weren't able to show up. So they were, for all intents and purposes, through this abuse, prohibited from appearing. So after the judgment came in and the court was asked to take a look at the interest issue, the court has to determine, was there a physical taken of the property. Was, in fact, this purported investigation nothing more than an actual physical taking of the property? We've already had the other requirements that we need, even if we were to do a pre-condemnation activity potential damage claim, an announcement a year earlier, the zoning issues a year earlier. This is well beyond the planning stage, and it's in the acquisition stage, and they have an affidavit saying we're acquiring the property. So this isn't a close call. This is an abuse of 37050. It's a thinly disguised order for immediate occupancy that Nevada Power Company has used. And that's exactly the way it was treated by the court. The facts are there to sustain the judge's ruling that the interest in the taking took place when Nevada Power went on to possession of the property and started doing their pre-construction activities.
But I guess that's where I'm trying to get the whole picture here. At the trial on this matter, pre-condemnation damages weren't an issue. Is that correct or incorrect?
At the trial before the jury?
Yes.
That was not in front of the jury.
Okay. And there was a stipulation as to the date of valuation.
There was a date of valuation as provided by statute, which was the service of the summons and complaint upon the landowners.
Okay.
As you would typically have. Not as to just compensation. There was no stipulation as to that, nor as to the date of the taking. There was no stipulation as to that. There was a stipulation as to the valuation date, which is service upon the landowners. But there are two different issues, too, Your Honor. One is, are we talking about pre-condemnation damages? And BuzzDo came out a year after the complaint was filed, so we weren't talking about it too much, although it wasn't under Barcy, or, you know, obviously the court had already introduced that concept. We were talking about, under the facts of this case, was there not, a fact, a taking when NPC Company went into possession 4 weeks before they filed their order shortening time for a motion for immediate occupancy? Should they not have filed the complaint at the time that they supposedly were using 37.050? Why would they need an order shortening time? What conceivable justification in a Fifth Amendment, Article 1, Section 8, Section 22 condemnation case would any condemning power in this state need an order shortening time unless there were emergencies?
I guess, why didn't you argue that September 14 was the date of valuation?
As far as...
Why would you stipulate to October?
We stipulated the date of valuation as the date of the service of the summons and complaint because the statute provides that the date of valuation is the date of the service of the summons and complaint.
Okay.
That would be... And if the taking took place earlier... We would look for additional compensation in the form of interest, which is exactly what the court ordered. As far as the offer of judgment rule, well, as far as when does the taking occur, and we had an order that we should discuss that. The taking occurs when there's a conduct by the condemnor, when there's an actual physical taking of the property, and here there was all this conduct plus a physical appearance on the property, but even more so under Sparks and Armstrong, the Armstrong, you know, is there something unreasonable or oppressive about this condemnor's conduct? Is the order shortening time, does it not shock your conscience that given the burden that has been placed upon the landowner, you're getting sued, you're having the privilege of your property taken, and you're given 48 hours in Nevada to come in there and show up with an appraiser to show a NRS 37.100 valuation, you have 48 hours to come in and prepare your defenses on need and necessity or public purpose. You have to hire an attorney and come to court in 48 hours. And clearly in this case, although I'm reluctant to use that term, the court, having seen all the evidence and having seen everything that Nevada Power had done to date, could very reasonably have found that the taking, in fact, occurred given the history in this case, and that the request for an order of immediate occupancy was itself an admission that the Nevada Power had delayed the proceedings, because also, they had delayed the proceedings.
Could you address the offer of judgment issue?
Certainly.
And the offer itself, whether how we look at that?
Well, the offer of judgment in this case came at the very last day before the trial. The offer of judgment was for an amount slightly more than...
It came before, it wasn't done, was it 10 days before the trial? Or
The 10th day.
Okay.
The 10th day. There was no prior offers, nothing. This offer came in for $345,000 at a point in time where all the experts had been hired. The costs were obviously very high as you get ready for trial. Any number of expenses. And
I assume quite a bit of attorney's time put into the case.
Sure, of course. You had the NITS firm having worked on it. We were working on it hourly as well as the others. And we received an offer of judgment that was included absolutely no severance damages and was inclusive of costs. And it was not anything that would have, it will included zero severance damages as well. Now, as far as the offer of judgment, you know, what has happened recently that would impact the offer of judgment? At a minimum, you have pistol, you have the Constitution that was approved by the court, and I apologize for the term. The court reviews it in November of 2008. It provides that there shall be no attorney's fees or costs awarded to the government. You have NRS 37.120, which says that the landowners in Nevada shall receive interest and costs without exception. And we don't need to torture these terms. Time and again, it is clear that the offer of judgment statute is not intended. It's not intended to apply to condemnation cases, as Justice Gibbons mentioned, with regard to divorce cases. There's no statute that says the offer of judgment statute doesn't apply to divorce cases.
Can you address Justice Hardesty's earlier question on Judge Vega's order regarding that point? She simply said that as a matter of essentially public policy and just compensation, is that sufficient? And is her reasoning sufficient in your eyes to support that conclusion?
We had requested a 37.175 hearing. The court entered a minute order on these issues. As far as public policy, one of the arguments that was made, we did cite the pistol legislative history, at least the comment that's been addressed here before. Pistol was relatively new. People were aware of these issues. And is it sufficient to say based on public policies? I think it is sufficient based on the state of the law. NRS 37.120 was brand new, even though it's simply to the extent that it finds that interest is part of just compensation, codifies this court's prior decisions. The statute was new. The constitutional amendment was new. The issue of utilizing the offer of judgment rule in a condemnation case is apparently, according to the
constitutional amendment. Well, essentially, she said it would be a violation of that concept of just compensation to overlap the offer of judgment rule on the condemnation type proceeding.
And just compensation includes, unambiguously, under both the constitutional amendment and NRS 37.120, interest and costs. It's not your typical case where you have interest and costs. This is just compensation. To the extent that you look at the offer of judgment rule and statute, it talks about interest and costs. It doesn't make any mention of just compensation. There is no other item of costs and interest that is treated like just compensation, that is elevated to a constitutional dimension. We're talking about Article 1, Section 8, and Sections 22. Just compensation is unique and is not subject to the...
Before you sit down, what are you asking us to do? I'm going to ask Mr. Chapman the same thing. What are you asking this court to do?
Well, we're asking on our countermotion to remand this matter for a new trial, based on the fact that we were precluded from offering distribution line evidence, that in the complaint and in the judgment, Nevada Power Company, despite the fact that Poynter says we're asking for one pole, has a whole litany of items that it is seeking in its easement, and that this is our only shot. The fact that it says we're just seeking a poll, but in fact it is seeking all different types of uses, and we were precluded from presenting any evidence about the distribution lines, and even though that showed up in the complaint and in the final order of condemnation in the easement. So we're asking the court for a new trial to remand this for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Nitzer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chapman.
And if you could just take a brief second to tell me what Nevada Power wants to, this court to do.
We would like it remanded to recalculate the interest that were awarded. It started too early. It should not start at September 14th, 2007, the date of a notice of injury in a previous case, which is not of record. It should start as of the date of the occupancy order pursuant to the Argier case in Nevada. That's November 20th, 2007. Moreover, the interest should not be compounded any more than once annually. This was compounded three times within 1 year, as explained in our brief. We would also like the offer of judgment revisited for an award of the power company's costs for a denial of the landowner's costs after the appropriate period per the statutes, as well as a stopping of the interest after the service of the award, as the statutes say. To recap on the summary or on the offer of judgment, 37120 is a statute that the court will want to look at in this case. It does not allow or does not say that offers of judgment do not apply. This is a matter of public policy. If it is the policy of the legislature as interpreted by this court, the landowners get a free ride, basically, to go in and try to hit a home run and get $1 million for a piece of property that the jury says is worth $239,000 in just compensation, then I guess that's the policy of the state and the court. The statutes don't say that, though. And costs, interest, these kinds of things are matters of policy. Attorney's fees are not part of just compensation pursuant to 37185. The amount of just compensation actually is what's determined after all of these rules and calculations of interest and so on are done.
Mr. Chapman, can I ask you one thing on the offer of judgment? I don't believe there's a statute that restricts offers of judgment in divorce cases. I think that was judicially created by this court. So doesn't your analysis fail, though, if we have a court case law that says you can't do it in divorce cases, why can't we do it in offer of judgment as far as condemnation cases as well?
Well, there is no court case that says offers of judgment don't apply in eminent domain cases that I'm aware of.
Well, we've said it in divorce cases. In other words, this court created the rule saying offers of judgments don't apply in divorce cases. It wasn't the legislature did it. We did it. So why can't we do it in this type of case as well?
I suppose that it opens up all kinds of doors of the court legislating. The legislature has already considered this in 2003 and decided not to do it. Will the court invade the province of the legislature and change the decision the legislature made in 2003? It sounds like a separation of powers issue to me. That would be my answer to that. May I also simply conclude, if it pleases the court, most of what Mr. Netzord ordered is not on appeal. He's complaining that he didn't have enough time before an occupancy hearing, which was continued in the Judge Vega case, to give him time to prepare. He was prepared. He presented us with a full narrative appraisal report on the morning of that hearing, which lasted all day. Judge Vega gave him plenty of time. The issue of just compensation is not even at issue at an occupancy hearing. All that's at issue is the amount of the appraisal of the condemning agency for the purpose of a deposit to secure occupancy. Nevertheless, she listened to him. He was thoroughly prepared. The date of value is set by statute. I don't recall a stipulation to the exact date, but it's the date of the service of the summons pursuant to 37100. And also, according to that statute, when they withdraw the deposit, which the exact amounts are in our briefs, but it's over $200,000, they waive all defenses except as to the amount of the just compensation eventually to be tried to the jury. So all these arguments that they were treated unfairly and so on should have been presented below. They were not, as far as I recall.
Mr.
Secondly, they were waived.
As to that particular point, though, in his concluding comment, he indicated that he felt that they were restricted in terms of arguing as to the use
as the distribution lines and such.
Thank you for bringing that up. That was he argued that vociferously in the early court and in the court below to Judge Vega, and he didn't get very far with it. And here's the reason: these are discretionary decisions of the district judge below. The ones we appealed up are actually legal issues de novo for this court. In the lower court, though, the judge was asked to make several discretionary rulings of evidence. The photographs, which showed other power lines, not the subject property, those were excluded. The fact that he was not able to argue the extent of the easement and so on, that's not correct. He argued very strongly on that. I remember his closing statement very well. He did a good job of that. The other point about the distribution lines, there was a plan that NDOT drew early on and then abandoned that showed an undergrounding of a pre-existing distribution line. That was not part of the county's or the power company's project. The other thing is, these are overhead lines. This project went through a planning process with the Public Utilities Commission, the Clark County Commission, which has to rule on these things. That's where you bring up what the project is designed as. As long ago as the Arrowville case, which I think is a 1937 case before this court has held and never varied from the fact that it is the government or the condemning agency which sets its project. Neither the district court nor the landowner is at a right as a privilege to redesign the thing, because the first thing they want is it to be undergrounded or moved somewhere else.
I'm going to, assuming that Justice Douglas's question has been answered, I'm going to call time for you, unless my colleagues have other questions. Thank you, Mr. Nitzok, Mr. Chapman, Mr. Storm, for your time and your attention. Case stands submitted, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.